It's Friday and time for our Friday panel discussion, and our guests on the panel this week are Susan O'Keefe, a journalist and director of the Yates Society, as well as a former Labour Party senator and general election candidate, and Tommy Higgins, well-known businessman, founder of Ticketmaster and currently chairperson of Sligo Rovers Football Club and former referee as well. Good morning to you both, and thank you for joining us on the Friday panel this morning. And I think we'll start with some breaking news from across the pond. The local elections there, which are increasingly looking like it's a bad result for the Labour Party, despite the relatively new leadership of Keir Starmer, and they've lost that seat in Hartlepool. And Sky News reports that the last time a Conservative was elected in Hartlepool, Cliff Richard was number one with Living Doll, Ben Hur was in the cinemas, Winston Churchill was still alive, and it would be 7 more years before England won the World Cup. 1959, yet Hartlepool is now Conservative. Susan, as a former Labour Party, maybe you're still in the Labour Party, I don't know, but as a former Labour Party politician, how damaging is this to the Labour Party in Britain, do you think, and to Keir Starmer?
I think as a first test for Keir Starmer, he must be pretty disappointed. It's a very, very bad result. Given that all the gossip was swirling around in the last few weeks about Boris Johnson, about his behaviour, about his private life, etc., etc., the public really didn't care about that. The public has been looking at the vaccination rollout. They've been looking at Brexit and thinking, well, the new figures are suggesting that growth in the UK will be 7% in this year, picking up, albeit from a very, very huge drop last year. So, you know, the voters on the street are not paying any attention to the kind of stuff that perhaps swirls around in the media. Keir Starmer does not seem to have connected with voters. That's the big criticism that's being made of him. And indeed, any time I've been watching him on television, because, of course, that's all I can do, I also kind of have that feeling that he's not really warmed up, that he doesn't seem to be connecting. And, you know, the voters will always give their verdict fairly fast. And it isn't just Hartlepool, it'll be the local elections as well across the country. I don't know whether the Tories will pick up in Scotland, but that's a separate question. Certainly in England, the Labour Party have huge questions to answer, as does Keir Starmer.
Okay, all right. Not so much Keir Starmer's leadership of the Labour Party or the popularity of the Labour Party. Would you not think that, considering all the stories that have been surrounding Boris Johnson, not least his aspects of his personal life and the money spent in doing up his flat, I mean, that obviously, maybe you see it as a worrying development or not, it doesn't resonate with voters. It doesn't seem to matter to people anymore.
Well, when you think about the year that we've had, the thing that's resonated with people has been their health, and the health of their families and their loved ones, and the fact that even though the UK left the EU in the middle of all of that, they then managed to really, you know, pull themselves up and say, right, we're going to vaccinate like mad. And they have, and they've been extremely successful. And people feel more buoyant about that. You know, the nation is opening up again. Shops are opening, pubs are opening, people are going back to work. And that seems, that does trump everything when it comes to it, excuse the expression, Trump. You know, Boris is, after all, somebody who's always been colourful, always been a bit irascible, always been a bit sort of different to the rest. And people seem able to forgive that. Yeah. And of course, locally, they're saying they will invest in the north of England. And, you know, that's where Labour was strongest. That's where the Tories broke through at the last election. They have to keep that promise. But certainly at the moment, touching the Conservatives would be a hard one. And Keir Starmer and his colleagues, by the way, of course, just haven't broken through. They don't seem to have a solid ground on which to stand. They don't know where they are, I think.
Okay. Right, Tommy, I'm sure you weren't up all night watching the local election results in the UK, but you have an interest.
I stayed up for a while.
Did you?
Well, there's a few factors there. First of all, Hartlepool really voted very heavily for Brexit. And they put up a Remainer. The Labour Party put up a Remainer, which maybe not have been a good choice. Then you had a very good woman candidate. She was a lady for the Conservatives, a farmer. And maybe she was just a better candidate. And I sort of agree with Susan. No matter what happens now, nobody cares anymore what happens. But Johnson can seem to do what he likes, same as Trump, Erdogan, all those guys. So, you know, they don't seem to be able to lay a glove on them. And also you have the Labour Party is all over the place. You have the Jeremy Corbyn factor, you have faction, you have the Ed Miliband, and there's just no single direction going forward. And here, Starmer, he's a very, very good operator, but just doesn't seem to have the star quality that you need, like Tony Blair, to drive it through.
Okay.
You're going to have that. I think the Conservatives will do very well. Nobody cares.
Yeah, before we move on, interesting point you made about the quality of the Conservative candidate, because it was never really a factor, or never usually is a major factor in British elections. People tend to vote for the party, do they not, as opposed to the candidate. It's completely different in the Irish electoral system.
Yeah, but, you know, she was a very good candidate. I saw some of the debates and... You put up a Remainer in a constituency that voted heavily for Brexit. That's their own problem. They'll have to face that later on, but that's the way they ended up. So there's a whole lot of factors involved there, but it's not good for the Labour Party at present. But I think it's too early in this cycle. I mean, you know, it'll take a number of years for the Labour Party to get themselves some sort of a message. And, you know, they'll have to unite in some way. I don't know what way it's going to go.
Okay. All right. Well, that's an unfolding story this morning. Susan, you've been following the COVID situation this week, and most of it, a lot of the commentary has had to do with the Donegal situation and Tony Holohan's comments about the dogs in the street knowing what's going on in Donegal, which has led to a raft of criticism and controversy. What are your views on this, and do you have sympathy for particularly those in South Donegal who believe they were unfairly tarred with the one brush by Tony Holland? And what are your views on the whole Donegal COVID situation and COVID in general?
It's obviously very difficult when, you know, we can see progress being made. People are more optimistic. You know, vaccinations are rolling out. The world seems to be calming down here, at least. And then it's very hard for people in Donegal to find themselves, you know, in the middle of a big flashpoint where there are so many cases emerging. And then I suppose to have Tony Holohan slightly off his normal kind of careful, kind of warm, connecting kind of behavior that he's been pretty good at all along. You know, he's had a hard 15 months for many reasons, personal and professional. And so I suppose for him to just, you know, maybe slightly, you know, go off piste for a moment, I would forgive him for that. I'm sure that people in Donegal find that difficult, but the truth is the facts speak for themselves. There are a lot of cases in Donegal. The numbers don't lie, and it will be within their power to help to reduce those numbers by going back to the basic things that we've all been doing and in fact continue to do mostly. You know, staying home, trying not to go outside the county, trying not to meet with their friends and so on. I think it's just very difficult and it's slightly unfortunate, but I don't think it's any kind of big thing for him. I just think for Donegal now, there needs to be a bit of support for them, you know, and the testing centres will help. And perhaps if there's any way of, if there are any extra vaccines to sort of give people a bit of a push to get over the line, because in the end, it's in our interest for all of us to be vaccinated and to be careful. You know, it's not Donegal versus the rest at all. It's all of us together, really, as it has been since the start. So I have sympathy for them, but I also understand what happened to Tony Holohan, I think.
Yeah, okay. Tommy, any views on that and the COVID?
Donegal is a very large county. You know, it's about 120 miles from north to south, and it's, you know, it's a big area. And people in the south of Donegal probably feel that they're behaving themselves much better than the people of the North Donegal. You have the border influence as well, people crossing over and back. So, you know, Mr. Holohan has done a wonderful job there, and nobody should be jumping on top of for every little utterance he makes. We all say things that we might regret saying at some time. It's a minor. I wouldn't be passing any heat about it. We have to look at ourselves. We're winning this battle now at this stage. We can see the light at the end of the tunnel. So look at everybody should chill out a bit on this and just get on with it.
Yeah, and I'm sure you both agree there are signs, and you'll know, Susan, being directly involved in politics, when Leo Varadkar makes a comment, even if it's perceived as an off-the-cuff remark, or Simon Coveney, as they have done in recent days, and Tony Holohan to a lesser degree yesterday, what they said is very positive. Leo Varadkar is talking about the return of indoor dining in July. Simon Coveney wasn't ruling out the possibility of travelling abroad yesterday. And Tony Holohan was talking about, what did he say, making the most of a summer. So these are positive signs, aren't they, I think?
They are, absolutely. And I think really for me to hear Tony Holohan say, you know, make the most of the summer, it's getting better, I really take heart from that. He's the one I would listen to most. And in a way, when you think about the difficulty for someone like him, who finds himself thrust into the public arena. I mean, politicians know what they're doing when they go for election. They are public representatives. And he has found himself in that space for a long time, you know, battling exceptionally difficult circumstances and trying at the same time to be calm and to be measured. So, yes, he deserves, you know, he deserves our respect. But I do listen very carefully when he speaks. And if he's saying to me and everyone else, you know, get out there and hopefully make the best of your summer, then that's what I'm going to do. And hopefully we'll do it here at the Yates building as well. But we'll continue, of course, to observe the precautions, because we still have a job to do. The virus hasn't gone. That's for sure.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Let's get your reaction now to something we've had a lot of comment on the show in the past 2 days, in particular, the minimum unit pricing for alcohol introduced this week. Tommy, is that something you agree with, and do you think it will do what it aims to do ultimately?
Well, I'm going to have to out myself here tonight. I don't drink at all, so alcohol doesn't make any, and I never have.
Yeah.
So, but all my family do, all my friends do. I enjoy going out with people. But we have a problem, especially at the youth end of it, and nobody wants to really face up to it. The politicians probably are scared of the people. That's really, they need to come down hard on this. And if I was in charge of all this, I definitely would do, first thing tomorrow morning, no alcohol in the supermarket. It's obscene when you walk into a supermarket and seeing cheap alcohol piled high, upside down, inside out. It's just insane.
No alcohol moderate at all.
Moderate drinking is fantastic. And I don't indulge in alcohol, but I've no objection to it whatsoever. But there's a very, very good model in Connecticut where they don't allow any alcohol in supermarkets. But I would open more off licenses and have them, you know, controlled. And so in Connecticut, there's no below cost selling of drink.
Yeah.
Don't open on a Sunday. And it's control the amount of retail outlets are controlled by the population. So and every 10 years it's looked at. Don't open on a Sunday. But the other thing to have as well, nobody can buy over 21. You have to be over 21. And they're very, very strict on how they manage it.
Yeah.
But what's happening now with young people, they're stocking up at supermarkets, drinking at home before they go out. Now, just I'm talking pre-pandemic times. And if we go back to that again, we'll be back at that again within another year. So, but I would be very strict on that. You cannot have that situation where it's very, very cheap to purchase alcohol. But I think it would be a lot better if you have them in off licenses and controlled.
Okay.
Of course, nobody's going to do what I'm suggesting. But the level.
Okay, your voice is going a little bit muffled at the end of that, but we got the point you were making. You wouldn't allow alcohol to be sold in supermarkets at all. And in relation to how strict they are in serving alcohol to over 21s, I remember I was over in the States not so long ago, a couple of years ago, and I got asked for ID, which is the ultimate compliment, I can tell you. Susan, minimum pricing, this is something that will work, and will it do what it aims to do, do you think?
Well, first of all, there is a lot of research to show that the price is a controller of how alcohol is consumed. I know that when I was in the Shannons, and while I'm not in active politics, nor indeed am I a member of the Labour Party anymore, but certainly when I was in active politics, I spoke on many occasions about the need do something about the price of alcohol for younger people. This is really targeted at those, that group, who literally can buy a bottle of vodka or some equivalent spirits for very, very little money. I mean, it no more tastes like vodka than the Man in the Moon, and it's extremely harmful. God knows what's in it, in fact. And that's part of the other problem, is the control of the actual production of alcohol itself. So there has to be something done. I'm delighted to see this move being made. I know it's not going to be introduced until January, but that's good enough if it's coming down the track. There absolutely needs to be something happening at that lower end, where the cheap alcohol, beer and spirits, are much better priced upwards and controlled more. I'm inclined to agree with Tommy. The problem is that when alcohol is available in supermarkets, it's available in your local garage where there's a shop, you know, suddenly it's the norm to be buying alcohol. And let's face it, we do have a huge problem in Ireland with alcohol. We do have many, many people, you know, in very poor health from alcohol and dying from overconsumption. So when you normalize something and have it available everywhere, then people think it's normal and they drink it and they drink too much. So I would be fairly strong on that and believe that it's about time the minimum pricing arrived.
All right, okay. Could
I come in here?
Sure.
I think you cannot just do it in the Republic and not have it in Northern Ireland. It's going to be, it has to be an all-Ireland approach on this, because it'll just be mayhem. They don't do it.
Because there was letters I saw on the national papers today exactly along those lines, that it has to be an all-island approach for quite obvious reasons. Okay, it's more than a sporting question, but the Manchester United-Liverpool game, Premiership game last Sunday, was postponed because of the protests by predominantly Manchester United fans on the pitch in opposition to the Super League proposals. Tommy, obviously you have a direct interest in this as chairman of Sligo Rovers Football Club. Well, what did you make of that protest and that situation, and indeed of the Super League proposals, which weren't very long in being scuppered, as we know?
I was delighted. First of all, I condone, of course, any violence that takes place with fans, but this was a huge result for fans all over Europe. And, you know... It was a silly move, but it had a stamp of America all over this. The three main clubs there were owned by Americans, and the American system is where owners own the league and they run the league and dictate everything. So I think that what the Americans were trying to do was to hijack all the top league clubs like they have in North America. You know what it's like with the NFL and the NBA, etc. But it was a great result for fans. I mean, I was listening to or watching an interview with the president of Real Madrid, Mr. Perez.
Yeah.
And he was whinging and crying and everything about how he can't survive his club and the need this money, etc. Real Madrid, and I looked up their numbers in 2019-2020 results, had a turnover of 750 million euros. Well, if Mr. Perez can't run his football club on 750 million euros, he should maybe look at another job.
Okay. And
now, there's obscene money floating about at that top end of the market. And in last year alone, in the pandemic year, 550 million euros was handed out to agents.
Yeah.
It's just insanity what's going on there at present. And the greed at the top. And I thought it was a great result for the fans. And it'll never happen, that Super League.
Okay, I don't know. Are you? I don't want to know your football allegiance, but are you a supporter of any of the clubs that were earmarked for the Super League?
No. Funny enough, I have no allegiance to any club. Now, when I was a referee, you were always a neutral. But I love world football. And I follow world football from South America to Australia. You know, I have a huge interest in it.
Yeah.
But I don't have an allegiance to any particular club. But I think it may have got that maybe from refereeing at the time that you were a neutral all the time.
But you were against the concept of this, the same teams being in this league every year, no relegation.
It was crazy. That it was the American model that they were trying to introduce, and that's based on as I said, the owners control everything. And it was all about the owners. They wanted to control everything. It's a very, very good system at present.
Yeah, okay.
Leave it as it is.
The competitiveness, I think. Yeah, sorry, Susan. Yeah.
Wouldn't it be lovely to see the approach going down the Bundesliga approach where it's fan-based and the rules are, it has to be fan-based. The clubs are all 50% plus owned by the fans. And it hasn't done the Bundesliga any harm as far as I can see, and they do fairly well. That really would be a result for football, for the fans. And as Tommy says, you know, any of us who've ever watched football, I won't put myself on a level with Tommy, but certainly I enjoy a good match, and I've been in the Rovers stands many times and enjoyed them. I'd have a soft spot for Liverpool, would be my club. You know, I would like to see football continue as a sport that entertains people first and that has that as its root. And if there were to be a change, I, like many people, would not like to see it go down the route of big money. And so if the Bundesliga can do it, perhaps the clubs in the UK could start being positive and making some kind of structural change. I mean, it would be huge and difficult to do. But I understand how people spilled over onto the streets. First of all, they felt it was possibly the first moment they could actually get out and protest because, you know, they'd all been locked down up until then. And it was a happy collision in time. And secondly, I mean, I lived in the UK long enough. I lived in Manchester, you know, surrounded by City and United fans and Liverpool fans. And, you know, people are exceptionally passionate about the game, and they are not going to go quietly. So unless some change occurs, I would be worried that big money might win out in the end. Because you may recall when United was first bought by Glazers, didn't the fans set up their own little club, which then ended up knocking around in the Sunday League or whatever after the first bout of enthusiasm. And that would simply have occurred because they didn't have any finance to buy players and to compete at any level.
Okay, this person says the biggest problem we have in this country is people preaching to us what we can and cannot do. It's a nanny state. Someone else makes reference to Boris Johnson, facts about Boris Johnson on Question Time on BBC One last night, saying an inquiry is needed and that in time he'll be held to account for the 127,000 deaths, COVID-related deaths in the country, and it'll all come out in due course. And someone else says Tommy was the best referee ever in the local league. So there you go. Can I ask you about political correctness, PC, and it was brought to the fore once again in an interview we had with the Agriculture Minister, Charlie McConnell, on Tuesday. And we were sent the briefing last week in relation to an online conference he was having. He wanted to get the views of fishers. I took a double take. I had to just check this. Did he mean fishermen and those in the fishing community? And he did, but apparently in government terms you can't use the word fishermen anymore, it's fishers. And opposition parties have been speaking about such matters as well, and they also referred to fishers as opposed to fishermen. Tommy, have you got any general views on language and
funny PC? Enough, I wasn't that much aware, but there's a headline in The Guardian this morning in the online version of, I think it's over that kerfuffle that was in Jersey yesterday. And the Fishers is in the headline. I had to have a look at it again. Oh, don't get me going on political correctness, but it's crazy stuff. People are jumping on everything. And you see, the social media has weaponized everything. You know, so you kind of 1,000 people coming down on top of something with the subject. And it's mad stuff, Niall.
Yeah.
It is too much. And everybody is jumping on everything, no matter what it is. And I've sympathy, a lot of sympathy for politicians and for people in authority that can't do anything without a tsunami of people jumping on top of them for the least little thing if a comma is out of place.
Yeah.
But I wasn't aware, to be honest with you, about the fishermen or the fisherwomen or whatever it is. I didn't know until I saw that headline.
Yeah, well, it threw me for 6 years. I had to find out were we talking about something completely different, because I'd never heard government department or minister refer to fishers, a consultation with fishers ever before, I have to say. And of course you're a chairperson of Sligo Rovers, isn't that right? Not chairman. One time you would have been chairman.
I think that's what it is, yeah.
Susan, I'm curious if you were involved, and it's just one example, if you were involved in the fisheries community, or if you were a fisherwoman, would you be insulted if the minister referred to you as fishermen?
I think because we're in a phase of change where language, people are more careful about language and people are choosing their own, you know, pronouns, she, her, they, and we are becoming more acutely aware of kind of removing the sort of male-female bias that certainly was there. And I think perhaps we're in the phase now, you know, where it all seems a bit mad and it all seems a bit difficult to manage, because it is every day of the week. There's another one you have to think about. And Fishers certainly wasn't one that I had heard of either. I do think, however, you know, for all of us to be more careful is no harm, because it is more respectful and it brings a better equality when people are taking care about how they describe people. But in this sort of more frenzied period that we're in now, it literally, we are watching the change happening. And because it's sort of random and it's being in social media and it's in the air all the time, it's very hard to get it right. Yeah. I mean, you know, the other one, obviously, the other thing is pregnant people. And that's one that I have a particular difficulty with, because as far as we know, up until now, pregnant people have been pregnant women. But yeah, there is a move to change that. So there are some of those changes that I will struggle with, and doubtless all of us will struggle with. But I'm not anti-changing if it does help people genuinely to be more respectful, but more importantly, to remove, as I say, that bias that has existed for years. Tommy is not the sort of person, nor would I be, if I was called a chairwoman. I would be called a chair. I don't think Tommy is too fussed either if he's called the chair, so long as it doesn't go anywhere else. You know, most of us are okay about things like that. But if everyone was still called a chairman, I think we would have a difficulty with that. So I do think it will settle after a while.
Yeah, okay.
But pregnant people, I do still have a difficulty with, and I'll try to understand why that's a better way of describing it. I haven't quite got there yet.
Tommy, do you want
to... I worked with an awful lot of women when I was with Ticketmaster, especially in Europe, and where women, they have a large role in corporations. I'd never entered into me what their title was or whatever. They were a colleague. That's the way I looked at it.
Yeah.
The type of people are called that, we get bogged down in it too much. I think Susan's right. It'll settle. It'll work itself out, and over the next couple of years, somewhere.
Right. Okay. Susan, are you? I was going to say, are you a letter writer? But more correctly, do you send letters anymore, be it personally or through your business? And if so, do you think you're getting value for money in the price of stamps going up by 10 cents? One euro and 10 cents now to send a letter.
I suppose, like most people, this pandemic has persuaded me back to the post box. I have sent more letters, and two of my family are living abroad, and so I have had cause to send them little gifts from home. And so I've used the post much more. And still in business, I would also use the post. And I would like to take the chance to thank the staff in the post office here in Sligo, because they've always been very courteous and very helpful. However, the problem I have, and they would be aware of it too, is that when you send something internationally, particularly if you register it and it costs a considerable sum of money, on post claims no responsibility for the item if it goes missing. So in other words, if you're posting it to Spain or the US or wherever it is, they just say, well, sorry, it's not our problem. It's gone into their postal system. And so it's lost there. And you're saying, but I paid you for the service. And they're saying, well, it's not our problem. That's the one I have a big problem with. I do not have a problem with 10 cent more on my stamp.
Right, unless you register it. I think there's some comeback.
No, I'm talking about registered post.
Even registered post.
If you register your parcel, and I've had it happen both in the business and personally, if it goes astray and you try to pursue it and you ring up on post and you ask them, they say, it isn't our problem. It's the US postal system. It's the German postal system. It's the Dutch one. Nothing we can do to help you. You can fill up a claim form. It might take you months. I had to pursue one loss here from a painting that we sent to the US, and it took 6 months to sort it out. and it was a nightmare. So that end of the business certainly doesn't work for the cost that you pay, but I'm very happy to pay my stamp, and particularly internally, post within Ireland is much better, I think, and much prompter, and the system's pretty good.
Never realised that to be the case. I always thought that if you gave the financial value of the contents of your packet and register it, then you would be reimbursed if it does go astray. I didn't realise that was the case. Tommy,
Try looking for it. They just don't want to know. They just say it's not us.
Tommy, are you a letter writer or do you correspond?
No, not as much. I'm...
You're there. Okay. Right, we seem to...
email all the time. And actually, I post them every year. And that's in a personal life. It's a difficult one for the post office. We really need post offices. And yet their main source of income, or a big source of their income, is gone, has been disrupted by email. And I can understand why it's now more expensive. But on Postar now, maybe their business model has changed. Now they're huge. They have a huge business in delivering parcels and delivering stuff for people who are buying by internet. So they're looking at their model has changed, but the stamp business has changed. But it's still it is very efficient. You know, if you post something today, it's tomorrow. It's in any part of Ireland.
Yeah.
And it's good that outside of Ireland as well too. I had no experience what Susan had and I wasn't aware of that too.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, they will pay compensation if you've put down your things right in the registration, but it's about if you ask them at all, if you say, well, look, I sent it, where's it gone? They just don't want to help, and I've had it happen several times, but you will get some compensation, but it's not an easy process.
Yeah, okay, that's interesting. All right.
Pay, by all means, buy the stamp and...
Okay, I want to ask you both a final question before we wrap up this morning, and it is COVID-related, of course, again, and people will be particularly interested to hear Tommy's views on this, I think, as chairman of Sligo Rovers Football Club. When do you think it's likely that crowds will be allowed to return, or do you think they should be allowed to return, even in a reduced capacity?
I know there's a huge pent-up demand for supporters to go back, and all sports. And especially with Sligo Rovers, we're having a good run at present. And I know from the comments, people are dying to come back into the stadiums again. It's not going to be that simple. It's not about, we could accommodate 25%, 1,000 people quite easily there. But I think it's the crowds going in and then shuffling out again. I think it's about the congregation of crowds that's the problem. And we have to stay with the scientists, and we have to stay with the politicians who are guiding us in the right direction. There is no easy way out of this. And apart from a handful of countries around the world, there aren't any major crowds going in to a stadium. They've started, I think, that 2,000 or 4,000 in Wembley a couple of weeks ago. That's out of an 80,000 capacity. So we just have to be that little bit more patient. I think we'll have, and it's all about the vaccinations. And we can see already where the numbers are coming down and down every single week. And I have to go with the science of this. As much as I would love to have the showgrounds heaving every week. And it's very, very difficult to go out there, and it's soul-destroying to it. Because games are not about... they're only about fans and the enjoyment of fans. And that's for every sort of a sport. So let's hope we have... When this started a year ago, my view was, you know, people were asking about what it was going to be like, especially the entertainment business. I said, this is a 3 to 5 year problem. We're into the second year now, and we're still not, you know, we're nowhere near coming back to normal. It'll only start getting back to normal from next year, what I call back to normal. It'll be gradually, bit by bit, places will open up. And I see the theatres are starting to open Broadway from September. That's near the end of the year.
Yeah.
But only to half capacity. And I don't know how that's going to work financially. So we have to stay with it. I think it'll be next year before we'll have full crowds back in the showgrounds.
Okay, well...
But I would be hopeful we'll have some sort of crowds by August, September. But they'll be small.
All right, okay. Final question to you, Susan. Yeah.
Yeah, if you consider, I mean, there are 48 clusters now in the UK of the new Indian variant. There are 10 cases in Northern Ireland. you know, all the doctors and specialists are saying, look, you know, we know this is going to carry on. We're going to have mutations. We're going to have mutations. Some of them will be more serious than others. So it will take time. And why would we risk all the effort that we've put in when things are still, the landscape is still shifting and changing? We don't have anything close to herd immunity yet. You know, people are desperate to get out and enjoy themselves, but if they can start by doing that, you know, in smaller groups, but not in any kind of an enclosed, organized space, then hopefully we'll all begin to adjust to learning about being outside and learning how to behave and getting a little bit more savvy about it. But for me, as long as those variants are floating around and we don't know if they're more dangerous or if the vaccine will deal with them, then let's just stay careful and stay safe, because that's what we've been doing, and we've done pretty well given all the constraints.